All right, got to get to the Dude Maker Hotline and say hello to a special guest, Carrie Gress, Dr. Carrie Gress, who is a writer, an author, a mother, stays very, very busy, and is on our Dude Maker Hotline with us here. Dr. Gress, I lament the fact that we got to you late again today, and you're free to you are free to upbraid me in any manner in which you choose to say, Mr.
No, it's great to be with you. It's worked out just fine,
Mr. Church. Do you know how to do you know how to read a clock? It's a good thing Cynthia sent me a text message. Did you get to Dr. Gress? I went, somebody was supposed to read the schedule this morning. No.
No problem. No problem whatsoever.
So, by way of introduction, can you give the audience just a brief bio before we get started?
Sure. Yeah. I have a PhD from Catholic University in philosophy, and I've written four books. My fourth book comes out in May, but one I co-authored with George Weigel called City of Saints, and it's basically a pilgrimage of Krakow, explaining how Krakow formed the man of John Paul II and all the places that were really important to him. I've written another book called Nudge and Conversions, which is about how to bring family members back to the faith. And then a third book that I've published last May is called Ultimate Makeover, The Transforming Power of Motherhood. And that was really based on my experience of realizing just how difficult motherhood is, but that as soon as I realized that there's actually a lot to it, that the difficultness of it is meant to be there, and that God really uses that to transform women into something much more beautiful than we imagine, then it got significantly easier. So that's what that book is about. So anyway, yeah, and then the fourth book that's coming out in May is called The Marian Option, and this, as you can imagine, is in direct response to Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option.
Yes. Now, that's what I saw, and I went, I'd like to talk to this lady about this, the Marian Option. Just a bit of bio about me. You're talking to someone that 3 years ago did the Marian consecration through St. Louis de Montfort.
Oh, great.
So I know a little bit about the subject, and when I saw the Marian Option, now that's an interesting one.
Right.
Now, can we agree that Dreher's Benedict option is not a Saint Benedict option?
I don't know if he's. I mean, I think he's got his own take on it. And actually, well, that was one of the interesting things about working on this book was I initially had researched him and his articles, and I didn't have the privilege of having his manuscript in front of me when I was working on my book, but. You know, there's some general things that he's clearly advocating for. And as I make the argument in the Marian Option, I think that a lot of the things that St. Benedict did were very time and culture and just part of history that were happening at that stage and aren't necessarily going to be, you know, well, they're not applicable to our current situation. And, you know, you've got things like drones and all of these details that certainly St. Benedict of Norcia did not have to deal with. And so I think there's some holes just even with technology in his argument. But I think the thing that I love about it is that it's gotten people talking about this.
It has.
As an issue. And so I'm incredibly grateful for that. But I was able to look at the Benedict option. I was really intrigued by it. And I gave a lecture about it to at the Acton Institute, Acton University last summer. And I contrasted it with the life of John Paul II, because clearly this was a man that had deep, deep experience with Christian persecution. And how did he deal with it? And really what came about was that this recognition that he offers us, first of all, a field guide to how to deal with Christian persecution, but secondly, that he was very Marian, and that all the things that concern us today, whether it's Islam or communism, or atheism, all of these have been dealt with throughout the last millennia, in particular by Mary, you know, in spades. If you look at what happened with Our Lady of Guadalupe and the massive conversions that took place in Mexico because of that. And so I kind of started off with this idea was, okay, we've got this John Paul II, who's this emblem of, you know, what Mary can do in our lives when we do consecrate ourselves to her. And from there, it was sort of this, it was almost like pulling a string out of a big yarn. And I started discovering just fantastic and amazing details about Mary that I've never seen put in one book before where you actually see all these geopolitical details about Marian intervention that they're just mind-blowing. So that's really what the book has become, is just this overall view of what Mary has done throughout the centuries, some sort of apologetics and an explanation of you know, how she's so effective and why she's so effective, and then really practical examples of what she's done in the lives of individuals. So that's kind of the book.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating read to me, and most people don't just start here on this continent. They don't they're not even aware of Our Lady of Guadalupe. We take for granted that mm-hmm. we have citizens of Mexico who can transgress the border and seeking work or whatever it is that they're seeking. But what we don't put into what is not realized is that were it not for Our Lady of Guadalupe and for her intervention, they may be transgressing the border as cannibalistic barbarians looking right. for looking for prey to sacrifice, right?
Right. Well, and certainly, there's a lot to that, but certainly polygamous too. That was one of the things that has been just the most astounding details, is to see how you had these Franciscan missionaries that came in and they were trying to convert the natives, and nothing was sticking because they didn't want to give up their polygamous families. And so when after Our Lady of Guadalupe came, we know that these were pretty significant conversions, because at that point that relationships and families changed almost overnight, as far as looking at a historical timeline. So I think that there are dramatic changes that happened because of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And I even sourced it back to the original Our Lady of Guadalupe that very, very few people know about, that was found in Spain during Islamic occupation of Spain. I think few of us know, I know I didn't know, that Spain was under Islamic occupation for almost eight centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And so before, as the Moors were coming in, some Spaniards had the vision to bury this icon of Mary that was so miraculous up by the Guadalupe River up in Spain. And then in 1326, there was a humble shepherd that had this image of the most beautiful woman that he'd ever seen. And she said, "My icon is buried. Please tell a priest, have it dug up, and then build a church." And sure enough, it turns out to be this miraculous image that said to be painted by St. Luke. And it had been given to the Bishop of Seville by St. Gregory the Great. And this is what they discovered. And so the church was built, and all of these miraculous events started happening. And it's very clear that everybody in Spain recognized that Our Lady of Guadalupe was behind getting the Moors out of Spain. In fact, in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella actually went to Our Lady of Guadalupe to thank her, as well as Philip II after the Battle of Lepanto. He went and gave a lantern to Our Lady from the flagship of the Turks that had just been defeated through Our Lady's intercession.
I did not know that.
it's just fascinating. I mean, it's almost like I feel like I need to just do a video with a globe and show all of these connections. It's just spinning it around, because it's just amazing. And it wasn't just Our Lady of Guadalupe that had these kinds of connections. I found them with also with Our Lady of Lourdes and with Fatima. So it's just incredible.
Now, what is also fascinating about if you see the Telma of the Mexican version of Our Lady of Guadalupe, that it's obvious. I mean, it just jumps out at you that she looks Central American tone in origin here, mm-hmm. and that that when Our Lady appeared and when the Telma was taken to the bishop as proof of her command to build that chapel up there, that she knew that to win over those souls of those cannibals and those savages that occupy that massive land area. Just look at it. Just look at the size of Mexico and Latin Central America. It's massive.
Right.
And of course, this ultimately spreads to South America too. But then it's obvious that, you know, the radiant glow, the skin tone there, and she made the Tilma to appeal to the savage.
And it goes so much deeper than that.
Okay.
There's just some incredible work that's been done on this, because one of the things that she's doing is there's this double entendre. She's speaking to the Spaniards because they already know who Our Lady of Guadalupe is. So they look at this image and think this is just another beautiful Madonna.
Okay.
Well, the natives, they see this image and it's just rich with symbolism. So they, first of all, her hair is down straight, which means that she is a virgin. Secondly, her head is bowed, which means she's not a goddess. She also has a tie around her waist, which means that she's pregnant. But on her belly, which is obviously a swollen belly in the image, there is the symbol that they understood to mean God, perfection. It's a little flower that's on her belly, and when you see it, it's very tiny, but close-up images, you can see it. So they can look at this image and immediately read Mary's story through these symbols. They didn't have a written language, but they use this kind of iconology. So they can see, within the first seconds, it's a virgin, she's pregnant with God, and she herself is not a goddess. And then there's just, it keeps going deeper and deeper. The stars that are behind her are actually the exact image of the way that the stars were in the sky at the very moment of the apparition. If you turn them sideways, they actually create a melody. If you put music staffs on it, it's just overwhelming how much is embedded in this image. And it just goes on and on.
I think you should write a book about this, Dr. Gress.
Gratefully, I have written a book about it. But there's some. I think there's one called Guadalupe Mysteries that I read. Ignatius Press published it a couple of years ago, and it's just wondrous. The image, they use a lot of pictures and great research, and that was a wonderful resource for me. To find some of this, but no, it's just incredible what is in that image. And some people will say, well, she didn't really say her name was Our Lady of Guadalupe. She said it was Coatlope, which is a translation of the woman that steps on snakes. Well, this is double entendre is happening, where she's speaking directly to the Spaniards with Our Lady of Guadalupe, and she's speaking to the natives who are going to understand she's a pretty important woman if she's stepping on snakes. So, there's this clear double cultural speak happening in one image. It's just amazing.
I tell my daughters, Dr. Gress, and Dr. Carrie Gress, the author of The Marian Option, a book that's coming out in May, is on the Dude Maker Hotline with us. I tell my daughters, who are not practicing the faith right now, but I'm working on them, I tell them, whenever you see a statue of Our Lady, it's an authentic one. Look at her feet. If there's no serpent head, if there's no snake under her feet, it's not an authentic statue. The person that made it was not devout and didn't know what they were doing, because she's always stepping on the head of the serpent. I heard some of the things that you were just talking about the Tilma. Mm-hmm. And the other amazing thing about it is cloth doesn't last 500 years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It just doesn't.
Yeah, especially that very rough, kind of linen cloth. This is unheard of. So it's just all the miracles associated with it are just amazing. Everything from, even in this book, Guadalupe Mysteries, they even look at her eyeball and what's reflected in her eye. And sure enough, there's Juan Diego. And anyway, I think there's some other figures in it. I can't remember exactly what's in it, but it's just astounding that we can see what she's seeing based on this picture and her eyeball. It's amazing.
Can we make the connection, or do you make the connection that cities in California that are settled and take saints' names? You just mentioned Juan Diego, like San Diego. That this doesn't happen without Our Lady of Guadalupe.
I don't think I took out the broader piece as far as it relates to California, largely because, the focus was on so many other details. There was really a lot of ground to cover. That's certainly the case that you've got. It's just the Franciscan missionaries. It's the 4 to 10 million converts that came from Our Lady of Guadalupe. I don't have an exact number, but that's certainly the presence of all of those saints in California has so much to do with her intercession there.
This is just fascinating and incredible. Dr. Carrie Gress, the author of The Marian Option on the Dude Maker Hotline with us. The book comes out in May. Now, I'm fascinated by it. I'm going to go pre-order myself a copy. Tell me more. Do you write about in The Marian Option that at one point in time, most Americans are not aware that the first city that was civilized in the United States is St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. And of course, let's mispronounce it so we can take the Catholicity out of it, right? Let's call it St. Augustine as if it's a blade of grass.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't go into that the settling of America per se, but one of the things that I do go into it at pretty great length, I've got a whole chapter on it, is just the role that she played in influencing culture. And you've probably heard of Henry Adams before. He's the,
sure.
the grandson of John Adams,
sure.
great grandson of President Adams. And he's got this fabulous book called The Education of Henry Adams. It was written in 1900. And in this article, it's a small work, but he explains going to the World Fair and just being fascinated by this new invention, all these new inventions that he's seeing, but particularly the automobile. And he just marvels at this, at how the world is going to change because of this invention. And then he goes on to say, you know, after I was sort of stupefied by this invention, I went back and thought about the influence of the Virgin in history and how, in fact, nothing can compare to the influence that this woman, particularly Mary, has had in culture. Now, of course, the first astounding thing about this is that he's a Protestant who's talking about all this. But he's living in Europe at the time, and he's seeing these cemeteries. He's seeing churches. He's mm-hmm. going past mm-hmm. Notre Dame Cathedral. He sees the richness of culture. He's seeing all of these incredible artworks and Madonnas and statues and paintings. And he's hearing the music that has all been composed in honor of Our Lady. And he says, you know, nothing is more powerful than this woman as a force of nature in the world. And then in 2015, National Geographic did an article about this. The journalist Maureen Orth speaks about how she is the most powerful, influential woman in history. And
wow.
This whole litany. So I really pick up on that and just talk about and make the connection that when we see the height of culture, it's really when you have the height of Marian devotion. And the two are really interlocking, that you can't really separate them as far as seeing in the West, that is, as far as seeing the height of culture and what it is that Mary, her influence that she's played. So if you think about why do people go to Europe? Well, they love going to these Gothic cathedrals.
Sure.
They love going to see all the Vatican museums. I mean, it's this kind of thing that pulls us, you know, Michelangelo's Pietà. It all comes back to Mary. And I once heard a priest describe culture as God's love made visible. So it actually makes sense that Mary would usher in, when we're devoted to her, that she's going to be able to usher in the richness and the height of culture.
I'm stealing that. So, God's love made visible. That's
it's perfect. I know. It really captures something, I think. So
is the Marian option then, it's not a formula for how of retreat or anything like Dreyer's
right.
proposing in the Benedict option. You're
not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. In fact, the whole idea is just a recognition that Mary is our mother. And she's got our best interest in mind, and she knows the whole picture. And she also, when we allow her, she's going to form us and transform us into people that are going to be able to change the culture in the way that's going to be effective. So it doesn't require moving. It doesn't require changing jobs. None of that is involved. It's pretty basic, you know, praying the rosary and Marian consecration, of course, the sacraments. So those kinds of things, but I do have a whole chapter that explains how it is that she transforms those that she loves and has used them very effectively. And I think this is where John Paul is just such a perfect example of someone that gave his whole life to her, and look at what she did with him as far as, you know, he brought down the Iron Curtain. I mean, that's hard to even really, you know, emphasize that. I think we've become, it's sort of become commonplace to us because we experienced it. But if you step back from it a minute and look at just what a dramatic change took place, the fact that communism ended theoretically in the Soviet Union, the fall of the Soviet Union, that happened without shots being fired, without a huge, massive war, without, you know, any nuclear detonation, it's really incredibly you know, it's just an amazing reality.
Do you know what I find is fascinating about all this, Dr. Gress? And I could talk to you about this from now until this time tomorrow, and we'd still be having a conversation. Of course, I'd bore you to tears. But what I find is the most fascinating thing about this is grown men, big, burly, grown men, on their knees, holding a Holy Rosary in their hand, saying, Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum. That is just the most, that devotion right there tells you all that you need to know about the power of Our Lady. And our Protestant friends misunderstand this. This is not idolatry. Just we're not idolizing. But because when we play, when you and I pray the fifth decant of Joyful Mysteries, and we pray and we meditate a little bit about the crowning of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and we see the 12 stars overhead for the apostles, what we're doing is we're asking her, okay, hey, your son loved you so much that he would not leave your body here in the fourth mystery as food for worms or prize for infidels, so you were assumed into heaven. No evidence whatsoever that there was ever a tomb site for the Blessed Virgin. None. Zero. Because she was, and read the vision of Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich, and you can actually see it. She brings it to life of how the apostles, who were all there, the ones that were alive, saw this. So you go from the fourth to the fifth, and you think about this. I have a direct link to our Lord, who has a direct link to God the Father, obviously. Right. You pray for her intercession. Well, why can't I go directly to Christ? Well, you can. No one says you can't. But you can also. Why not get two? Here, you get two for the price of one, right?
Two for, exactly. Yeah, and I think that's why part of my book is slightly apologetic in nature, because I'm explaining a lot of this. Why, you know, God set it up this way. He's a God of abundance. So Christ came to us through Mary. It only makes sense that we go to Christ through Mary. She's this incredible conduit of maternal love that's available to us. And I think the other reality is, because Protestants don't have a sense of, you know, it's a misunderstanding of worship versus veneration. And I talk about that too, that these are very different realities.
That's right.
And just the way that you would respect someone who was an elder or your own parents. This is a kind of veneration for someone who goes well beyond that, because she was the mother of God. I mean, even if we take away all of the other attributes of her, purely because she was the mother of God, there should be this fundamental respect for her that sadly has been erased because of this concern that there's idolatry happening when in fact it's not happening at all. So.
Well, and look at the beauty of the Marian artwork. For one example, here's one example. The statue was making a tour. I'm not sure if it's still touring the U.S., but the statue of Fatima.
I just saw it 2 weeks ago. It's still going around. Yep.
Breathtaking, absolutely beautiful. Just you look at that statue. I can't imagine anyone with an open mind who sees that does not say, "Wow, that's the mother of God." She's so beautiful and breathtaking, yet so simple. And it's the modesty that we're missing in our culture today is feminine modesty. And this is the fault of all of us. But you can find it and you can imitate it by doing an imitation of any of our ladies. Insert Our Lady here, Guadalupe, Fatima, Lourdes. Do you write about that?
You know, it's interesting you mention that. I have a whole chapter called Are We in the Age of Mary or the Anti-Mary? And I was fascinated while I was doing my research, noticing that you always have this male-female complement when you're talking about whether it's Adam and Eve or Jesus and Mary. You've got Jesus called the new Adam, Mary's called the new Eve. And it struck me that there's no complementary person to the Antichrist. We know St. John talks about the Antichrist being something of a movement, and Scripture talks about it being a person. But I think looking around our culture today, just smack me between the eyes, that we really are living in the age of the anti-Mary, that women have adopted something far more vicious than just, you know, old-fashioned vice. But in fact, there's this huge movement that is turning everything on its head that is Marian. So something as fundamental as valuing babies, valuing
life
is now so corrupted and deeply controversial and so confusing for so many people. And, you know, that just scratches the surface. But even the way that women comport themselves, and certainly there are people that I could point to that you could say, well, she might be an anti-Mary, Madonna being one of them.
Oh, yes.
You know, look at just, I mean, it's just incredible how awful some of her videos are and sacrilegious. And anyway, so it's been fascinating to sort of consider this angle of the anti-Mary and what's happening in the culture and how this, not only how this affects women, but how this affects men, because we really collapse this notion of eros, you know, where a woman has the ability to draw men to something deeper, to draw them to God. And really, women are called to emulate Mary in that way. Mary is this bridge to heaven, and women have the same ability when, in fact, they are reflecting and living a godly life. But because we've shirked that, and, you know, you can't watch a TV show now with a commercial now without seeing the idiot men on the commercial, you know, we've really minimized their dignity. But in addition to that, we've taken away eros from them, and we've left them with only the erotic, with you know, and this is one of the reasons I think that pornography has become such an epidemic, because of the fact that there's not this sense of lifting up the souls of others, whether it's our husbands or children. But in fact, we've collapsed everything into sort of this sexual realm, and completely leaving out the spiritual side that is so powerful in transforming culture.
Now, and look at the simple beauty and the power of the example of the Holy Family.
Yeah,
she does this
true.
To Saint Joseph too, because you know Joseph could have run, and so necessary is the example of the Holy Family to for us to imitate and to emulate. Mm-hmm. That God sends an angel and tells Joseph, no, I'm telling you, she is with child by the Holy Spirit. You're going to raise that child, and you're going to marry her and make her your wife, and then you live in a Josephine marriage for the rest of your life. And he does it. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's no. It's to me, the part of the nativity story that people miss is not the birth of our Lord. Of course, is the main event, but there is another event there, and everything that happens in the gospel, of course, is intentional. All of it's there for a reason. That we get the example of the Holy Family, Dr. Gress. You get it there, but I don't think in our modern world that people think of in my ex-wife's home state of Maine, Holy Family Credit Union. Mm-hmm. There were banks named Holy Family. Now, what else could that possibly mean other than that there was veneration for the Holy Family, right?
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and even just looking at, it hit me a few weeks ago, just looking at who's at the foot of the cross. You've got John, you've got Mary, you have two other Marys. Well, it's no accident that these other women are named Mary.
That's right.
They're all called to emulate Mary. And all women are called to emulate her. And this is why there's this repetition of these two women who have the name Mary also at the cross. So, yeah, it's when you start looking at these things in the detail, in the specific details, it's just overwhelming and incredibly beautiful. I actually have an article up right now on the National Catholic Register where I talk about, you know, we're just spending a lot of time discussing this way of beauty, the via pulchritudinis, and how beauty can bring people to God. But one of the areas that we don't look at all, we look at art and architecture, and these things are important and beautiful and do have a profound effect on culture. But we've completely overlooked the role that women have in this. Women are beautiful. You know, we're made to be beautiful on purpose, and our vanity in many respects is a distortion of that. And so anyway, if listeners want to read more about that, it's, I think, currently in the top 10 reads of the National Catholic Register.
I'm looking at it right now. The beauty of women will save the world.
Right, right. So it's the title is far more ambitious than that, how I originally put it. I think we can save the world. But no, it's pretty simple when you look at the role that women have in their families. And also looking back at the history of conversions, where you've got someone like St. Monica or St. Helen, who were deeply influential in converting both their husbands and their sons, and that had profound effects for the future. It didn't start with this role. And you see that over and over again looking at the Romans. St. Cecilia is another perfect example of her own converting her own husband, and then they were both martyred. But that influence is very deep and very important. And I think women have lost that sense of what our mission is. And this is why we're so unhappy. I think in my book, Ultimate Makeover, I talk a lot about, you know, this focus on feminism and what it is that women are supposed to be achieving. Well, what has it achieved? Are we happy? And all of the happiness index, as I call it, is showing that we're not happier. Our obesity rates are greater. Drug use is higher. Suicide rates are higher. You know, there's not anything among those kind of telltale signs that is showing that women are in fact happier. And I think that part of this is because of the fact that we've lost our sense of mission and what it is that God is calling us to do.
Before you go, Dr. Gresko, I know I was only supposed to have you for half an hour, but I have a question or a mention from a listener who just converted.
Wow, okay.
And he converted because a telephone rang while he was in South America, and he answered the phone, and on the other end of the line was, "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you." Now, he was a devout Protestant. And he converted, and while he was in South America, he began a devotion to Nossa Senhora Aparecida, or Aparecida, Our Lady of Aparecida. Do you write about her?
Yeah, I don't write about her. I only use the 15 apparitions that have been approved by the Vatican itself, not just bishops. And that was plenty as far as just being able to call a massive amount. But I don't know if you're familiar with The Miracle Hunter, but he's got some great work out there, and just talks about how he told me recently there are 2,500 apparitions out there that have not been studied,
really
proved. It's just overwhelming how many apparitions of Our Lady are happening. And I just didn't want to venture into anything that I thought could swing the other direction, and then I would have to explain why I've got an unapproved apparition in my book. So it was a lot easier. And frankly, this book would have been 7 times longer if I hadn't even ventured in remotely to some more of these apparitions.
So, well, I have a little statue of Our Lady of Aparecida, and again, she appeared. She is legendary to have appeared to those natives as one of them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
She looks like one of them.
In Akita, Japan, the image has Japanese. Feature, image of Our Lady has Japanese features. Yeah, no, she's very good at speaking to her audience. I mean, she's got that rhetorical principle down, know your audience. So we could certainly learn a lot from her, I think, in that respect, as far as our messaging, that's for sure.
Now, who is the publisher? Is this an Ignatius Press book?
No, it's Tan Books is publishing it.
Thomas A. Nelson Books.
Yeah, well, yes. It's. I think they've changed the initials. It was purchased by St. Benedict Press down in Charlotte a couple of years back, but no, they're doing fantastic stuff, and they've been great to work with, and they're putting pictures in it that illustrations that make the point as well, and I'm just really excited about it. The cover is gorgeous. I think if you look online, you can see the front of it, but what you don't see is that there's a picture of Mary standing over Chicago, but the image of her wraps around the backside as well, so you get this sense of her really. Present to the darkness that we're experiencing in the world today.
It's Aparecida, I'm being informed. I'm mispronouncing the name. Aparecida.
I wasn't sure if you made a hard C either. Anyway,
Aparecida.
And it's from Brazil, right?
Brazil, right.
Okay.
Now, I'll tell you one thing before you leave. In finding the consecration process and going through it, and finding a work, Father Philip Wolfe recommended in a sermon that I heard. He said, go get this book by Padre Gaetano Maria de Bergamo called Humility of Heart. Went and found the book, and Tan was the last English publisher. And I discovered in the book, I fell in love with the book, read it cover to cover, that Father Bergamo, Padre Gaetano, had written an entire devotion to the Blessed Mother in the book. And Cardinal Vaughan, Herbert Cardinal Vaughan, died. He was the translator into English because it was written in Italian. He died before he could translate that section. So, Dr. Mm-hmm. Gress, enterprising guy that I am, I got the Italian original press from 1734. I translated that devotion. It's 57 pages. And put it into the edition that we published. And I'd like to send you a copy because it is...
I love it.
Have you read it?
No, I haven't read it.
Oh.
So it sounds wonderful.
Well, Father's entire point, Father Bergamo's entire point is you can get to, there are no saints in heaven who aren't humble. He says there are some that were filled with charity and this and that. All of them had humility. And the quickest way to humility is through the Blessed Mother.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
He wrote an entire book on it and then a 57-page devotion. And it goes mystery by mystery on each of the three mysteries of the Rosary. That's how the book ends. And it's just it's a little how-to guide on how to be a better Christian, basically.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's what Mary does. I mean, if you look at the denominations, Christian denominations that have not been able to flourish, they've abandoned Mary, and you see it very clearly. They've abandoned the Eucharist, or they've abandoned Mary, or they've abandoned both. And this is why, you know, so many Christian denominations are struggling so mightily and splintering further and further because of this lack of understanding of the role that Mary plays as far as just the distributor of graces and what comes from her. And this last century in particular, Paul VI wrote so eloquently about that. St. Maximum Kolbe's written eloquently about it, and just the tremendous role that she plays in our own faith formation and mission.
Well, the hashtag on Twitter for the Benedict option is hashtag BenUp. I look forward to hashtag MaryUp making.
Yes, me too. So yeah, we had the goal of the 100-year anniversary of Fatima to get the book out by then, and that's on the 13th of May. And the book comes out May 12th, so we're pretty excited to have made the deadline.
I cannot wait to read this. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be pestering you for a review copy before the actual book is published.
Oh, great. Well, good. Send me your address.
I will.
We'll get you one.
Dr. Carrie Gress has been my very, very special guest today. Gosh, what a rewarding way to spend 31 minutes, Dr. Gress. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We'll talk again soon, and I will be sending you a request, and I will send you a copy of Humility Heart. I hope you'll enjoy
it. Fantastic. Thank you. I appreciate it.
God bless. Thank you.
You too. Ciao.
All right.